parent at least was deported back to Guatemala, their country of origin, without their child. Of those 4,000 cases, Legal Learned of the ACLU estimated that 10 to 20% affected Mayan language speaking Guatemalans. That's an enormous, that's not just of the Guatemalan asylum seekers, that's of all of the families separated. So the kind of scale of the problem was what most surprised me when I began reporting this story.
Rachel Nolan's piece in The New Yorker is a translation crisis at the border. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Odilia Romero is a Zapotec interpreter with the Binational Front of Indigenous Organizations. For the full conversation, go to democracynow.org. Monday, Dr. Martin Luther King special.
We must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance.
Hear Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence, featuring excerpts from his talks and conversation with Dr. Dorothy Cotton of Dr. King's staff and King's eldest daughter, Yolanda King.
But when he was not about business, he was a bit of a cut-up. He was a jokester.
That's Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence.
Airing Monday, January 20th, between 4 and 6 p.m.
Nostalgia. It's a song, character, or phrase that takes you back to your younger years. With one melody, you're back in the place you grew up, reliving that moment, enjoying it all over again. No matter how old we get, we can always be drawn back to precious memories. Relive your great memories during unlimited screen time every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. All of the classic and current movie, TV show, and video game soundtracks will be heard on the station to remember. The only station making waves, 89.3 WHFR.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio, from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn.
Good afternoon and welcome to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek along with Susan McGraw. I guess we'll get this out of the way. Happy New Year. Happy 2020, our first show of the new year, right?
Oh, so excited to be back. Alan, I, as I know you are as well, we have appreciated the programming that you were so kind to select during our sort of our time away for the holidays. Very interesting. I very much enjoy all of the components of what we're learning in these off weeks, but really good to be back and, in the saddle to be able to talk about these local and interesting issues affecting our own community. So happy to be here.
Indeed. Well, and important to be here because later on we're going to talk about the critical need for blood donations here in Michigan and obviously around the nation. We'll be talking with Todd Kuhlman from the American Red Cross here in Michigan. And hopefully, you know, if you've got some time over the next couple of days, maybe the day off on Monday for the Martin Luther King Day holiday, maybe an opportunity to do something positive and make a blood donation. Of course, here at Henry Ford College, we do the Day of Service, which you know, we didn't have a chance to talk about before the Christmas break. It was on our agenda, and yes. and just for some reason, I don't even remember exactly why. I'm sure it's already filled up, and it's really one of the most amazing things that takes place on campus, other than the education we provide over the course of the year. So.
And Cassandra Fluker with the Office of Student Activities does an amazing job of making opportunities available for students that are interested, but also helping to recruit students that are sort of on the fence or have never considered trying something like a day of service on a special day to honor Dr. King's legacy. So we will absolutely look forward to inviting Cassandra in a little later. In, I think, early February, we've talked about getting her in to talk about what the next phase is.
Correct.
Black History Month as well.
Yep.
So there will
lots of activities.
Lots of opportunities there. So, but thanks for bringing it up. We are so excited to kick off our sort of live season of the new year with the leader of Henry Ford College. And I had the pleasure of listening to our president at the State of the College event, which took place, boy, it seems like it was like a month ago, but it was really just like kind of just the other day. So we're happy to welcome back to our studios Russ Cavalluna, the president of Henry Ford College. And we're rested and ready to go, Russ. So there's your warning call. But just know that we're looking forward to hearing about your vision as we enter this 2020 year. And you've been here long enough now where, you know, we can pull out the hard questions.
I was going to point out where you didn't introduce him as the new president Ford College, just simply as the president of Henry Ford College.
And I like the sound of that, and I'll bet you do too. Welcome,
yeah, I do. Russ. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Alan. It's good to be back with you. I count you both as colleagues and teammates, and happy new year to you both.
Thank you so much. We are looking forward to learning about some of the bigger overarching goals that you have, both personally and professionally, as we continue to grow together as this wonderful institution for our students, for our internal constituents, as well as our community at large. But what are some, let's just start with the easier stuff. What are some of the things that you've noticed or experienced in your time here, 18 or so months, that you're either most proud of or most interested in, and that you've spent some time really learning about, and you maybe know more and know differently about them than you did when you started?
Well, the thing that I'm most proud of, and I really do see it every day I interact with the campus. In fact, I was out there today, and I walked into a class. And the thing that's always so impressive to me is the breadth of students that we serve here, that we really have the privilege of serving. These are people who have decided to invest in themselves through education. And if you walk around our campus, as I do very often, you really do see this extraordinarily diverse group of people all investing in themselves in education. There are people who are older than you might expect in college, people that are younger than you might expect in college. You know, we have over 2,000 high school students on our campus. We have an average age, which is 27. So that tells you there's learners that are in their 30s and 40s. And when you walk around and see them, you can see that they come from backgrounds and religions and socioeconomic statuses that are so diverse. It's really, really exciting, and I'm proud about that. And if you interact with them, you find that this is a vibrant community of people who, despite all those various backgrounds and differences, share a real passion for learning here. So that's the first and foremost thing that I use it as a well of energy and pride. Whenever I'm down in my office and I get a little down because of the this or that, if I get out and interact with the students, then it really lifts me up. And then the second thing that's right behind that is the people that I'm so proud to work with that do the educating, the faculty, the staff. It is really a vibrant community of people who care about students and want for their success.
We are excited to always talk about the numbers. You know, the numbers are this, the numbers are that. And when you're here every day seeing the people and learning the stories, the numbers kind of don't matter as much, but it's sort of a trend. It's kind of a thing. You always want to talk about the numbers. We're doing pretty good with the numbers, so that's a positive thing. And you said something at our State of the College address, which, by the way, when Dr. Mike Mead introduced you from the Board of Trustees here in Dearborn, he's a blast, as we all know, and just was so funny and profound in his words. But one of the things that you said was students vote with their feet, and I love that. I've heard it before, but I'm going to give you the credit for that, because it is absolutely so true. And we're in the winter semester now, so we've had a lot of students that have gone through classes in the fall. They have the choice, the decision to come back or not to come back, and it looks like many of them, most of them, have come back, and we've got some new ones as well. Why is that the case?
Yeah, well, I do say students vote with their feet because they have a lot of options when it comes to community colleges and four-year institutions in our vicinity. And you mentioned, Susan, that sometimes the numbers aren't the most exciting thing, and I'll acknowledge that. Really, the most exciting thing is seeing people in the classroom, in the community that we have here as a college, and the staff and faculty interacting with them. But I will tell you that one of my main jobs is to make sure that we have a balanced budget. And our budget relies heavily on tuition, which is directly affected by enrollment. So I watch enrollment a lot. And what you're alluding to is, in the State of the College address, I did reiterate that I focus on enrollment a lot because it helps our budget. But also, I think it indicates whether students see value in what we're offering them. And I say students vote with their feet because if they are not finding value with the tuition they're giving us and the time they're giving us in their lives, then they have other options. And we're here in Dearborn, and I'll tell you, about 60% of our students come from outside the city of Dearborn, and that's something I'm very proud of because they come to Dearborn, they come to a community college, and some of them actually drive past other community colleges and other universities. And that is an indication that they find value in the things that you and Alan and other faculty members give them, which is a meaningful education. And so the way I test that, besides just walking through classes and asking them, and that's a really good way to get a first blush test of that, a more thorough analysis is, what is our enrollment? And you compare, typically higher ed administrators and myself compare the previous term. So we compare today's winter term with the previous winter term, and we frankly budget whether enrollment will be up or down because that'll affect how much we have as revenue and what we can deliver as classes and services. And we budgeted to be down 2%. Higher education has been down across the state of Michigan, and this institution, Henry Ford College, has been down for about 7 or 8 years. And in the fall and in this winter is the first time, and I've counted since 9 years ago, we've been up in enrollment when compared with the previous term. That's really exciting for me because part of my job is to make sure we can pay the bills. But it's also really exciting to me because I think it indicates what I've always been saying about this institution is that when we show people what we have as the vibrant community that delivers meaningful education, the market, and the market is our customers, the students, they respond. And so I say they vote with their feet because if you talk to them, you ask them, where are you from? You'll hear a lot of different places. Then they are literally moving their bodies to our campus for the education.
Well, and part of that is, you know, getting them to appreciate what we have, but there's also that other element of pivoting in a fast changing world to what those students need. Am I correct?
Yeah, you are. And I mentioned we were here, I think, a year ago talking about this, and one of the things I mentioned was the set of things that students expect for support in their educational journey is different than just 5 years ago. Because the world they're encountering is so different than just 5 years ago. Think about it, Alan. When you and I were in college, it was a simpler time.
Much.
It was a simpler time to get to college. It was a simpler time, Susan, to get out of college and to find a meaningful career. And frankly, our parents, when they got through college, if they had the blessing to do that, they could find a career and stick with that career for the rest of their meaningful working lives. And our students are bombarded with challenges to get into education, then challenges through education, and then challenges to make value out of that education. And so, yes, students expect us to support them to get in with an effective enrollment process, to help through the process of getting an education through meaningful and high-class faculty, but also counselors to help them deal with the social and emotional issues that they encounter, academic advisors and career counselors to help them deal with the professional decisions they've got to make while going through education and then what to do with it afterward. And then from leadership in my office and vice presidents, they expect us to be able to maneuver this institution such that the education and the pedagogy offers value. So today's academic higher ed consumer is very, very knowledgeable, and they will, as I say, vote with their feet if they don't think that we're adding value to what they're giving us, which is their time and their tuition dollars.
Yeah. Russ Cavalluna joins us today, president of Henry Ford College on the WHFR Journal. Thank you for being with us. A couple of things based on what you just said. One of them, I think, sort of one of the most humbling experiences of working not only in a community college setting, but in this particular setting, is just knowing, as you indicated, kind of how hard most of our students have to work to get in there, to get into the classroom, to get that seat, to be able to be that sponge and do that learning and so on, which is very different than other circumstances in higher education than some of the university settings and so on, where maybe they don't even want to be there, but mom and dad are paying, so they're just kind of whatever. You know, and that exists too, you know, in maybe some small part, but that's not the student that I see here at Henry Ford College. But I suppose what that would require of us then, and us with your leadership, would be not only seeing the changes and responding to the short-term things for the students that are currently here, but also making the planning and getting the infrastructure in place to be able to kind of forecast and respond to what we think is going to be the need down the road. Now, I know some of that relates to technology. Some of it relates to relationships with other business institutions and other, you know, facilities in our community at large. But that's got to be a pretty daunting component of what you do. How do you address that?
Well, if there were a book that I could read to tell me how to address that, or if there were another community college president around the corner that knew how to figure that out, I'd go watch, because it really is a multifaceted, difficult problem for which a sophisticated college will be evaluating in real time all the time. But the first part of your question addressed the myriad obstacles that students in any higher education world, but certainly in a community college in Southeast Michigan, the myriad of things that students that come to our college face. And I put them in two buckets. One of them is financial, and that's a serious thing because, 50% of our students get financial aid. A high percentage of those are Pell eligible, which is the federal government's identifying students that are of a socioeconomic status that deserve federal tax dollars to get an education. That tells you a lot. You won't find 50% financial aid at some of the four-year institutions, and that's a serious problem, and financial barriers are serious. And then there's a whole host of things that I call the other stuff. So you've got the financial barriers and all the other stuff, and that involves working part-time or full-time while coming to school, family obligations, whether it's siblings or children themselves or adults that our students have to take care of. The difficulties of finding what one is interested in enough to devote time. These are all very difficult hurdles that students have to overcome. And we have taken the approach that it's our job to both attract students to see the value here, but then while they are here, find out what they need to be successful. And many times community colleges aren't so good at that. In fact, many times colleges will focus on getting people enrolled but not retaining or helping them to success. And so just this last fall, we rolled out something that your colleagues in the faculty, I hope, find useful, and that is an early alert program for students who, during their first several weeks of a term, if they show reasons and indicia that they are having trouble with school, it allows faculty to identify them to the administration quickly so that we can marshal resources to that person very quickly. Because what we found is some of our demographic of student will struggle, but also not have the wherewithal to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And I see it all the time. I hear about faculty who have their own homegrown processes to help students. And I know all of you do that, and I see it, and it's wonderful. And I remember getting some of that help myself when I was an undergrad. But what the institution and leaders like myself need to do is give you the option to communicate with us, and us as administrators and support mechanisms get in. And so that early alert program was piloted in the fall, and it's live now. We've already received 9 early alert warnings to try and help students for all these types of other issues. And that's where I'm focusing now, is the financial burden is there, and I'm happy to talk to you about all the great things we've done to lower that burden. But then the next frontier for us to really serve students is all the other things. And this early alert program, I think, is a great way to start that.
In learning more and more about the challenges that our students are facing, we're able to address them, but it sometimes kind of seems like a vicious cycle, and I don't think it's ever going to stop or end, but at least softening or assisting as much as possible to kind of break that one day is certainly the goal I think that we all have. And then looking to the sort of the longer term, the things related to policies, related to investments in finances now that we can set in place programs that might benefit those students, like you said, that aren't quite sure what they want to do. They want to go to school. They don't have one specific passion, but they know they want to make a living. And certainly with the skilled trade and apprenticeship stuff going on here in Michigan right now, there are more jobs than there are people. That's where we come in. So what's happening as far as that goes here at Henry Ford?
Well, that is exactly right. And that is something that I've focused on like a laser since I came here. And that is identifying employers who acknowledge that they have a skill shortage. They have positions that are open and not being filled. I have gone to as many as will listen to me and say, we have both the facilities and the human capital to deliver the skills to our students that you need. And my goal is to find employers who want to partner with our college. And the gold standard there would be to guarantee a job after a student gets through some curriculum, whether it be a certificate program or a degree program or a transfer program. And I will tell you that we're making progress. We're not as far along down the line as I would like, but we do have those agreements with DTE Energy and Ford Motor Company. And my plan is to replicate those And we're not just talking about this. We've been planning, and we will now start building a $15 million expansion to our technical education center that will grow the scope of the students that are in, for instance, the Ford asset program. These are students that when they come here, they learn how to work on Ford vehicles. They deploy during their education into dealerships. And when they come on the outside, those dealers take them on with nearly a guaranteed job. DTE Energy is a similar thing where we have several, I think we're over 30 poles in the back, utility poles in the back of our campus where students are going to be trained how to become linemen at DTE Energy and other energy industry employers. I hope that when we expand this technical building, and it'll be over the next 2 years, we will do that in the skilled trades, in the cybersecurity arena, in the entrepreneurial space, and we're calling it a maker space. So if we maneuver this college right, we will answer employment needs and thereby answer what our students want, which is a return on their investment and their education dollar. That's what they're demanding. I think over the next 2 years, you'll see us try to make partnerships with employers to answer that demand.
In looking at some of the pluses, some of the most exciting things that have happened since you've been here, I can say, well, first and foremost, what we always get from you in discussions, the consistent message, and I don't mean we always get it like it's a bad thing. I mean, it's a good thing. Let me just be very clear on that. But it's that concept of you're here, you support us, you're with us. And when I say us, I mean really the campus community at large in every aspect. And that's comforting. It's exciting, and it's a very profound thing that I think without that component of leadership, it would be hard for everybody to be on board for all of these things that we collectively want to, but also really need to do to provide that product, which is the best support for our students. So in 18 months, that's what I've experienced, and I know every colleague I've talked to feels the same way. So for that, we're truly grateful and appreciate your willingness to communicate, your open-mindedness, but also your tenacity. I mean, we've had our governor, we've had our lieutenant governor, we've had bigwigs and higher-ups in the state and beyond here, seeing our campus as a showpiece and a future showpiece for some very exciting things. So for that, we are very grateful.
Well, I think I'm in and involved in this community because it really breathes life into me. I'm here because I am excited about what we have here at the college. And, on the topic of VIPs visiting us, I'm excited to tell you that in the first week of February, the Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, will be here talking to our students and our community. I'm inviting the entire community here to talk to us about civic engagement, the redistricting plan that her office is tasked with doing, and then also registering to vote and voting. The reason I keep asking for important policy leaders to come to our campus is because when people come here and see you and our students and Alan and our facilities, they leave impressed. And that's part of my job. That's the thing I like so much about this job, is shamelessly bragging about Henry Ford College and everything that it is. And the biggest, most valuable part that I can brag about is the humans that involve themselves in this institution, starting with students, faculty, and staff. So it seems like tenacious, but I will tell you is it's the enjoyable part of my job. And so I can promise you that you'll keep seeing me out there and I'll keep bringing people to brag about this place.
Well, good. You're very good at it.
What about the challenges? It's great to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, oh, that went great, or this is completely on track. This is where it needs to be. What are those challenges and what are the things you worry about, whether it's, competition with other institutions or the cyclical nature of an economy or things like that? Or, what are those things you're just sort of keeping your eyes open for with your peripheral vision here?
Yeah, so I'll tell you two major buckets of those things. One is the financial standing of the institution. It's my obligation, aside from going and being involved in the community like I enjoy so much, it's just as important that I can make sure each year we understand how much revenue we'll take in and how much expenses we will take on. Our revenue is essentially in three streams. One is tuition, and that is why I focus so much on enrollment, because mm-hmm. that is the only lever that I have really to help the institution understand its or manage its revenue is by increasing enrollment. And I will tell you, I shamelessly note that enrollment is pivotal to this college. The other, one of the other major streams is state support, and that comes from the legislature, and that is something that I will continue to advocate that we increase. Now, the governor has the right to propose a budget, and in her first budget this year, she proposed a 3% increase to community colleges like us. The legislature came back with a 1% increase, and I'll be continuing to suggest to anyone that if you want a high return on your public dollar in higher education community colleges, particularly those like Henry Ford College that have over 10,000 students and serve the most diverse and lower socioeconomic status, those are the colleges worth investment. And I'll continue to recommend people look and ask people running for office, what's your view on public education? Do you believe we should invest in higher education? And I will continue to say, if you can find people who say yes to that question, then they deserve your vote. Now, Alan, the other thing you asked about, so the finance and whether we can meet our obligations to continue to deliver fantastic education, that's one thing that I worry about daily. The other thing I worry about is serving students safely. There are all kinds of threats that we see and we manage each day, and they go from the terrible natural disaster or, God forbid, some kind of attack on our campus to the more mundane but just general service providers. So, for example, we just had our first day in the winter term, and you may have heard that there were several parts of our website and portal that were down. And you might imagine that I hear about that. And, you know, when those things happen, and by the way, we're just kind of talking before the segment started, remember we have to deal with weather here. And you remember when the polar vortex came through and I closed campus, and there were several people happy or unhappy about those decisions.
5 minutes after my class ended, by the way.
See, so I hear about these things.
It was one of those, yeah.
And what I want to tell you about those things are that I struggle with those because it's so important for us to set up and deliver, both for you who work here and particularly for those who come here to learn, that we can provide the safe place for learning to take place. And the silver lining on those clouds that I fear come in, those clouds of the internet may be down, or maybe we'll have a problem with snowstorm, or maybe, you know, one building's power will be out. The silver lining there, and I've seen it happen a couple times, and I just want to share one little anecdote with you all about this, is they are opportunities for me and my team as administrators to learn and do better, but they also are that for the students. Because the reality is what I've just described about the dangers or the risks or the kind of challenges about living in this world when you're delivering a service is the world that these students are going to go into, whether they're at an insurance industry job or whether they're educators themselves or whether they go run a business. And so an example was, yesterday afternoon, I got a really, really grumpy email from a student talking about the portal being down. I mean, really grumpy. In fact, nasty. And I was working through it. And as I say, if you send me an email, whether you're a staff member or a student, you're going to get an email back. I've kept that promise, and I will. So I emailed the student back, and I essentially said, I recognize your frustration, and I'm sorry that we went through that. We're going to do better. And then I kept going through the email chain. You guys may do this. And sometimes you say, well, this person sent me another email. And they sent me another email at 1:30 a.m. And I thought, oh, man, this one's really going to be on fire. And you know what? You know, it was a student. And the student said, when I sent that earlier email, I was really frustrated. Mm-hmm. I regret having done that. I'm sorry. I know you're working hard. And I hadn't even responded yet. And I thought to myself, you know, this is the kind of growing and maturation that takes place at a community college. I suspect and I feel confident that that student had the benefit of some teacher or staff member at this institution that helped them think through how to handle their frustration. And just the growth in the 6 hours between those two emails, as evidenced by them, was really, really touching. And so I try to see the silver lining out, mm-hmm. Alan, on these kind of risks. These things, I would say, finances and whether we can safely deliver what we promised to deliver are the things that are challenges. I'd say that with any industry, but certainly when you're asking people for the privilege to educate them, those are the kind of things I think any good administrator would keep at the front of their mind.
Well, we have enjoyed our time with you. It's just flown by. I'm so happy to have you back in our studio, and we won't wait a full year this cycle to get you in again. But grateful for your leadership and your time as well today in addressing several of the issues that have been pressing, and we want to make sure our community understands. But final thoughts, anything as you look at your 2020 vision here in particular that you want to share?
Oh, it's flown by because I've been talking the whole time and I could keep talking, but I'll just say a couple things to the community. We're going to do two major construction projects in the next 2 years, and I'm really excited about that. We've set up the funding for them. They're going to be putting our institution as a leader in both delivering technical education for skilled trades, construction jobs, and cybersecurity. And then we're also going to rehab the entire campus to reduce our energy expenses by 50% in the next 10 years. And that will pay for itself because of the reduced cost. And we'll be playing our part as a global player to reduce our footprint. If I'm talking to the students who are going to listen to this, I'm with you. I support you. If you see me on the campus, say hello. I'm excited that you're here. Everyone who works here is devoted to your success. And if you don't feel like that's the case, let me know and I'll address it. And then to you and the faculty, Susan Allen and your colleagues, I'm excited to be working with you again. I'm a year and a half in, so I'm just starting to kind of get my sea legs. And man, I'm so happy that I'm here, and I really appreciate the work that you guys do for our students.
Thank you. We thank you for your time today as well.
Say, President Russ, it's great to have you on the show and give you the platform to speak directly to the community and answer some of the questions on our behalf from both the community and the campus community as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. We wish you continued success and understand that you're a very busy man, so we're gonna let you get going. But don't be a stranger here as well. If you've got something interesting, particularly that you want to get direct to, you know, connection with, you know, we're here as well. And that's one of the things that we're very proud of at WHFR Radio.
You should be. Happy New Year. Go Hawks.
Thank you.
It sounds good. Susan, let's roll up those sleeves. Give time to give some blood. We'll be back in a moment with Todd Kuhlman from the American Red Cross talking about blood donations here on the WHFR Journal.
I'm just excited about the cookie.
All right.
Attention Henry Ford students. The college's winter 2020 semester is fast approaching. Here are some important dates to remember. January 13th, classes begin, and January 19th is the last day of late registration. Please visit hfcc.edu for more information.
Anderson Coleman on WHFR, bringing you Blues with a Feeling. Come over to 89.3 FM on Saturdays, 8 to 10 p.m. Enjoy classic and vintage blues with expert analysis.
Come on, baby, let the good time roll.
The Darkness of Birds is the new recording from Amy Petty. Listen to Songwriter Symposium this coming Sunday, January 19th at 5 o'clock. Amy will be my special guest on WHFR Radio for a live, on-air, in-studio performance.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. We are understanding and mindful of the ever-present need for blood donations, not only across Metro Detroit, but across the United States as well. And rather than waiting for the first or the next blood drive in our own community, we thought we would bring in the top guy here relating to communications with the Red Cross, the American Red Cross, and that is Mr. Todd Kuhlman. So Todd will be joining us on a telephone line to talk about not only the need for blood donations at this current crisis, this critical time, but also truly just how easy it is to donate. So, Alan, have you done the blood thing
before? Typo. Yeah.
Typo?
I'm OPAS. I've done it many, many times. I've even done the double reds and the plasma thing or whatever.
Yep.
So just on and off, yeah, over the course of years, it's just it everyone's got it in them, right? So it's just something that you do, right?
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That's a great statement. I'm A+, of course, right?
Okay. You know, yep.
That's what I strive for, an A+ all the time. But I'm A+. And ultimately, I have to say I'm so proud of the fact that I come from a blood donor family. My dad is in like the 50-gallon club. I mean, I made that up, but in some type of a club like that. So it really does kind of seem like it's something that you are kind of brought up to know is the right thing to do. And you know, this is just normal for many people. But we want to kind of appeal to those people that aren't currently or normally or traditionally blood donors, because if we didn't, you know, if we had everybody just continuing that already donates, we, you know, we might cover it, but when we get into these urgent needs, we're not covering it. It's not enough. And that's where Todd comes in. So, Todd, I'd like to welcome you to our WHFR Journal, and let me indicate your title. It's very impressive, the External Communication Manager in the Biomedical Field Marketing and Communications Area of the Red Cross. So what exactly,
wow.
Yeah, what exactly does that mean, Todd? And
get us started. I should be so lucky, you know, someday to have the title.
That's a great title.
That's a lot of words to describe what it is me and my teammates do across the U.S. But, no, basically my role here in Michigan, we have two blood regions here in Michigan. Listeners to WHFR are part of the Southeastern Michigan Blood Services region. That encompasses five counties in the Southeastern Michigan area: Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Washtenaw, and St. Clair counties. Pretty much the rest of the state encompasses the Great Lakes Blood Services region. It's about 60 counties that we cover and provide blood services for. So Michigan is made up of two blood regions, and I am basically responsible for basically what I'm doing this afternoon with you, talking about blood, promoting blood donation, and getting the word out as to why that's so very important.
Well, we are sure that you have the information for us, but you've certainly got the voice for this job. Let me put it that way.
Ellen and I were talking off air, and he can tell you a little bit about my background.
Yeah, a little bit of background in speaking into a microphone, whether it's a telephone or a microphone.
There
yeah,
you go. Indeed. Well, why don't we start with the most pressing component of why we've invited you on, Todd, and that is this critical and very urgent need. It's the need to call to our the people that aren't the normal and traditional blood donors, because we're assuming that those are already donating. So, you know, what's happening, why the need, and what can we do about it?
Right now, the American Red Cross has a critical shortage, and that's for type O blood, which I believe Alan said he was an O positive.
Mm-hmm.
We urgently need those type O blood donors right now. Type O negative, type O positive, also platelet donors, which I can explain a little bit if you want me to. But yeah, right now we do have that critical shortage of those two types. However, the need for blood is constant. Every 2 seconds, somebody needs a blood transfusion somewhere in the United States. So while the need for type O is critical right now, we urgently need all other blood types as well. So we are certainly asking folks right now to just give up an hour of their day, schedule an appointment, and just help save lives. It's very important right now. We're coming off a pretty rough winter, not so much here in Michigan or Metro Detroit yet, although that could still be coming.
Yeah.
But we've had some lots of cancellations on the East Coast. The Southeast area got hit pretty hard as far as some severe weather, which did cause a lot of blood drives to be canceled. In fact, just between Christmas and New Year's, we had about 500 fewer blood drives hosted during that time. A lot of that has to do with holiday travel. Folks are kind of putting blood donation on the back seat while they visit family and friends over Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. We are, obviously winter weather does affect our blood drives. We will often postpone blood drives if the weather is not right. We certainly don't want to put our volunteer donors in any kind of a precarious situation as they're trying to get to those drives. And we're getting into a pretty a serious flu season right now across the United States and including here in Michigan. So all of that kind of coupled together certainly makes for a challenging blood collection period, and that's where the American Red Cross is right now.
When we talk about how much is adequate to be, you know, coming in to be received on a, whether it's a weekly or monthly or daily basis, I'm not sure how you sort of measure it, but could you give us just an idea of the scope when you say we're critically low, you know, percentages low? How much blood are we actually talking about?
Well, right now, the American Red Cross has a less than 3-day supply of blood products available to the hospitals that we serve. The Red Cross strives to keep a 5-day supply on hand. So you can kind of see the, you know, the seriousness there. We are, you know, 2 days short as to where we like to be as far as our blood supply is concerned, because it's important to remember that it's the blood on the shelves now that helps in the event of emergency tomorrow or next week. It's something we constantly have to replenish and keep stocked, because you really never know when something can happen. We are part of a national network, the American Red Cross, so something that may cancel a lot of blood collection in the East Coast, maybe out west, wildfires, that sort of thing. Obviously, hurricanes play a big, big role as far as our ability to collect blood in those areas, but we're able to move that blood around. So maybe if the situation isn't as dire here in the state of Michigan or in other regional areas, if there's an area that is in need, we certainly can move blood to those areas. So you can see we need to collect as an organization nationally about 13,000 blood donations every single day to serve patients in need. Here in Michigan, it's about 700 collections per day, and that's between those two regions I explained earlier, the Great Lakes region and the southeastern Michigan Blood Services region, which is, again, part of the WHFR listening area.
Well, let's put it out there then. Okay, for people who are interested in donating blood, and you know, every once in a while, I think a couple times a year, we do one here on campus at Henry Ford College, and you know,
absolutely,
everyone goes in and they feel they've done their part. You know, where is the resource to go to find you know, some of those donation centers?
Absolutely,
at these crisis times.
Yeah, I mean, it's at this crisis time for sure, but this is all the time. We try to make, you know, give our donors or those who are maybe interested in donating blood every opportunity to find that appointment that's nearby and schedule that appointment. The old-fashioned way, if any of your listeners aren't computer savvy, I find that hard to believe anymore, but 1-800-RED-CROSS is, you know, our long-standing way. If you want to find an appointment, you can call 1-800-RED-CROSS. It's as simple as entering your zip code, and blood drives will, you know, be presented to you as far as within your range. Our website is a fantastic resource, not only to schedule a blood donation, but also to learn about blood donation, what happens to your blood, what are reasons you might be deferred from donating blood, what are the popular blood types, what, you know, just a bevy of information, a lot of FAQs, way too much to go into during this discussion, but redcrossblood.org is our second fantastic way to schedule that blood donation appointment. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, we have our new, well, it's not so new anymore, it's been about 3 years now, believe it or not, but it's our Red Cross Blood Donor app. It's a free download. You can find that app on our website, again, redcrossblood.org. And this is really, really a neat thing. It's been incredibly popular. You can actually find your blood donation opportunity, schedule your donation. You can challenge family and friends to donate and have like a contest. And you can also actually track your lifetime donations through this Red Cross Blood Donor app. And as we say, it puts the power to save lives right in the palm of your hand.
Wow. I'm literally downloading that app as we're talking. I just want to kind of play around with it in our discussion here. Didn't know it existed.
Yeah, get in there and download it. It's free. And it's really, really neat. And I'll tell you what, it's been so popular just because everybody is locked into their smartphones nowadays. And obviously, that's a you know, very important audience to reach now. It's not so much telephone and not so much internet, although internet on those phones, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We oftentimes have a community, as I mentioned about my dad, who has just, I think his dad always donated, and so he donates, and now the kids, you know, we as kids, children donate, and we have our children donate, that kind of a thing. But oftentimes, some of this tends to still be, even with all the technology and everything, sort of grassroots when it comes to like a church drive kind of a thing, or a community service organization drive, like Alan mentioned, the ones here at school. But I think I remember the first time that I ever saw my dad give blood, it was at our local church, our local parish, in the gym. They, you know, the Red Cross blood mobiles were there, and I just thought, this is the coolest thing ever. He is like a hero. Do you still do that kind of stuff?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you what, community centers, churches, high schools. We have a very big presence on Michigan State University, University of Michigan, as you mentioned, Henry Ford. We do a blood drive, Oakland University. All those opportunities are certainly what makes us, or allows us, I should say, to complete our mission, which is to provide blood to patients. And it's a constant thing. We're constantly looking for new locations, maybe new community groups. We do a lot of things with local municipalities. We just had a drive just a couple weeks ago with the city of Farmington. We do things like that all the time. So you never really know where it's going to be. Most of the time, we have recurring drives at those locations that you maybe have seen the Red Cross signs or the banners out in front saying donate here, that type of thing. But I'm always looking for interested community groups to maybe host a blood drive, and it's very important that we continue that.
Well, and who helps conduct those blood drives? Are these certified nurses or health practitioners, or how do you know people even in the healthcare community that you know I'm assuming want to volunteer their time? They're not making retirement money off of being a part of blood drives. How can people like that get involved?
Well, I mean, I can tell you the folks who are at our blood drives, it's our collections team, which mm-hmm. are all certified nurses that draw the blood, phlebotomists, if you want to use the technical proper term.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Those are the folks that are doing, and they are American Red Cross employees, and we couldn't do what we do without them, obviously. But there's so much that goes into it. I mean, we have folks who obviously need to set up these blood drives. We, you know, mobile drives are a big, big, big part of what we do as far as going to those locations that Susan was discussing. We need folks to transport all the things that you need at a blood drive, the beds, all the materials. We have our Red Cross, canteen area where obviously folks, after they make their donation, can kind of replenish with, you know, juice, cookies, or whatever snacks. So it's a major effort to put on a blood drive, and it's one of those things obviously that we do, and we do it every day here in the state of Michigan. In fact, we do it between 25 and 35 times a day here in the state of Michigan.
Wow. We know the American Red Cross does more than collect blood, and we hear that, you know, that organization name associated with so many support opportunities for people in crisis and community circumstances. Talk just briefly, if you would, Todd, about beyond the blood drive component of the American Red Cross, just for a minute, sort of the overview or the overarching scale of what other types of things you're getting into. And also, should somebody be interested in learning more about those other aspects as well, maybe to provide some funding or even some fundraising?
That's a fantastic question, yeah. The Red Cross just isn't about blood donation. Obviously that's my field and my focus as far as our organization is concerned here in the state of Michigan, but we also have a humanitarian services side of the American Red Cross, and that is the emergency responders. Everyone has, you know, seen, there's an apartment fire on Mack Avenue. The American Red Cross is here providing support. 12 families were displaced. The American Red Cross is assisting those families. That's one very, very important aspect of what we do. And you can kind of expand that into, obviously, hurricanes and wildfires.
And tornadoes. We had some down in Texas and Oklahoma.
Absolutely.
Recently, yes.
Yep, flooding incidents. We've seen plenty and plenty of that. And, one of the first things I encountered when I came on board this organization back in 2012 was Superstorm Sandy, which hit the New York and Long Island area and was devastating. But Red Cross folks are sent to the scene and to assist in so many ways possible with food and shelter and comfort and mental health discussions. It's a very important part of our humanitarian services side. We support the armed services. We have our American Red Cross Armed Services Wing, who supports families who are overseas, veterans, getting word from family members here in the States to those who are serving overseas. We do so much for the armed services, and that's another really, really big aspect. Of course, we do CPR training. Actually, we have a babysitting class, babysitting training. So many aspects of that side. So it's something that there are a lot of blood collection agencies throughout the country, not just the Red Cross. We collect nearly 40% of the blood here in the United States, but there are other organizations that do just what we do, and they're doing great work. But the Red Cross is really the only one that can say that we do all those other things that I just explained.
In talking about sort of the myths or the misconceptions, Todd, let's appeal now to the person that hasn't done it.
The obstacles to donating. I can't it because the government's going to be tracking my blood.
Or I'll get something.
Right, exactly. They're going to know if I do drugs or whatever.
So just briefly, let's see if we can sway a couple people. Let's just see if we can sway some people to make the right decision today.
I'm all about that. Let's start. Okay, you want to donate blood, you're on the fence. I can tell you those on-the-fence donors that I've met throughout my time, I think the number one thing that they're concerned about is, first of all, either they don't like needles and they think it's going to really, really hurt, or they're just not sure how they're going to feel afterwards. I can tell you, first-time donors or those who haven't done it, take your fingers on your right hand, go to your left forearm and just pinch yourself. That's about what it feels like as far as starting the blood donation process.
And if you need to, close your eyes. Don't look at it.
Absolutely. Yeah, look away. Squeeze that little power ball that our collection staff will give you to kind of keep your mind off it. You know, if you have a friend with you, talk to them. But it's so funny because I've met so many first-time donors, and they didn't even realize that the blood was being drawn until they looked over and they're like, hey, whoa, I'm actually donating blood right now. And as far as that's concerned, we'll start over. You make your appointment. You show up at the location where you have made an appointment to donate. For starters, a blood donation takes about maybe an hour from the start to finish. But once you complete the health history, there's a brief questionnaire to fill out. You'll go into a private area with one of our trained collection staff nurses to just do some brief health things, blood pressure, that sort of thing. Once you're on the bed and you're giving that donation, it's only about an 8 to 10 minute process. So it's pretty quick once they start the donation and you're actually up off the bed and enjoying some great snacks. There are ways now. We actually have a new thing called Rapid Pass. As I mentioned, it's about an hour from start to finish, but you can shear off about 15 to 20 minutes of that with our Rapid Pass. It's a pre-donation thing. It kind of cuts out, you know, the questionnaire, all of that stuff. You can actually do that from home, from a laptop or a smartphone on the day of your donation. So say you get up in the morning, you're going to donate at 11 o'clock in the morning. You're up at 7 having your coffee. You can fill that out, get to the blood drive, and we'll have you in and out of there way less than an hour. I mean, you'll save about 15 to 20 minutes. And again, you can find that information once again on our website, redcrossblood.org.
It's like your little TSA pre-check.
Yep, it is. It is exactly that. And as I mentioned, there are our website is a bevy of information about blood. And, you know, there are reasons you might go to this blood drive all anxious to give blood, and maybe your iron is low. Maybe you didn't have a really good breakfast that day. Obviously, there's a number of reasons you could be deferred. Maybe you've been out of the country. There's a number of things, and way too many to kind of go into specifically here. But we often just tell folks, hey, try again. If your iron level is low, next time just make sure you have a big iron breakfast, if you will. Lots of beans, meats. Just eat well, be well hydrated before you show up at the blood drive. And I can assure you, you're going to come out just fine. You're going to feel good. And you're going to feel good inside just knowing that you've helped save lives.
And that's what it's all about. How often can we donate if we decide we are feeling so inspired and so empowered by the process that we want to do it again?
Every 56 days.
8 weeks. Right. Math. 8 times 7. 56. Yes, correct. Yes. All right. Yeah, I got that one right.
And good job.
And you'll kind of notice, maybe you don't notice. I mean, I notice, but we, as I mentioned, a lot of those churches, community groups, universities, high schools will have recurring drives just about every 8 weeks. And you can kind of see why. We have that group at that area that donates regularly. You talked about your father, Susan, being a longtime blood donor, and you mentioned 50 gallons. I've met a gentleman just last year in his 90s, still donating blood, and he's almost up to 70 gallons of blood right now.
That's incredible.
Every 56 days you can donate whole blood, and we have so many people that do that just regularly, and those are those folks that we certainly recognize when they hit, 5 gallons, 10 gallons, 20 gallons. When I met that gentleman, I was blown away. He started donating blood back in World War II and has been a Red Cross blood donor consistently since that time. And as I mentioned, he's in his 90s and still donating.
Let's circle back again to sort of the urgent need specifically right now, and maybe just sort of reemphasize that point as we start to wrap up our interview, Todd.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, kind of the start, we have a critical need right now for type O blood. Again, type O negative, type O positive. That encompasses really our need right now is for all blood types. Those are the specific types that we have a very critical need for. O negative, universal blood type. It can be transfused into anybody regardless of their blood type, and basically is what an emergency room doctor would reach for in an emergency before they were able to determine the patient's blood type. Right now, less than a 3-day supply. The Red Cross certainly likes to have a 5-day supply on hand, and I think the important thing, the need for blood is constant. Every 2 seconds, somebody needs blood in the United States.
That's empowering to know that we can be a part of supporting this process, and it's also a very powerful message. This nifty app that I downloaded, it's got some great stories of some people that literally have had their lives saved from blood donation, from blood donors.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, it's very cool, very cool.
Recipient stories, and they are so important. Just this week, I was we had a series of Gardner White blood drives. Actually, just took place yesterday at like 9 stores at the Gardner White blood drive furniture in Metro Detroit, and just met a wonderful family. Young daughter Lena, who is suffering from leukemia, or should I say, she's battling leukemia and battling it quite strongly, but. She has received so many blood products throughout her treatment, and her story is a really, really, as you mentioned, empowering and very, very inspiring. And that's the type of patient and person that you're saving or helping save with your blood donation.
Yeah, it's incredible. The website says, or the app says, your donation can help save up to 3 lives. Help saving up to 3 lives just by doing something that is perfectly natural. It's not going to hurt. It's going to feel good in the long run. So we're so happy to be sharing this message and so grateful, Todd, for your time today. One more time, it's 1-800-RED-CROSS if you want to go the old school way, or go to that, download that Red Cross app onto your smartphone. You can get to it through any site, or go to redcrossblood.org, and you can find all the information you need. We've sure appreciated your time today, Todd. Continued success with getting the word out, and we're just happy to be a part of this process.
Well, I appreciate you too for giving us the chance to kind of describe the process, and I hope some folks listening today are maybe who are on the fence are thinking, you know what, I think I'm going to do it.
It's not that hard. I just got to say, it really isn't. If you're afraid of needles, just look the other way, and then go have some cookies afterwards, and your blood's going to be on a path somewhere that's going to save somebody's life.
Yeah, you got
it. Right. And just a real quick thing is, you never know when you may need blood.
Well, that's true too.
You could be the one in a hospital emergency room who is requiring a blood transfusion, and that blood only comes from volunteer blood donors. So something to think about.
Thank you so much, Todd, for your time.
Todd.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Certainly.
Thanks. Susan, it's been great being with you on today's edition of the WHFR Journal. We've got Kitty Love coming up next for a trip down Highway 61. Enjoy your day of service on Monday for Martin Luther King Day holiday.
Yes, absolutely.
And we'll be back next week to talk once again.
Sounds good. Thanks to our President Russ Cavalluna for joining us in the early part of today as well. And you know, the reason we have the day off on Monday is maybe to sleep in a little bit if we can, but really to do something different, do something special in your home, in your community at large, to honor the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So consider that and have a wonderful weekend.
Yeah, I don't even know if those blood centers are open on Monday, but if they are, do it. If not, pick another day to go and donate some blood. All right, this is WHFR Making Waves.
We must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance.
Hear Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence, featuring excerpts from his talks and conversation with Dr. Dorothy Cotton of Dr. King's staff and King's eldest daughter, Yolanda King.
But when he was not about business, he was a bit of a cut-up. He was a jokester.
That's Martin Luther King Jr.'s Path to Nonviolence.
Airing Monday, January 20th, between 4 and 6 p.m.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's MatchingDonors.com. MatchingDonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit MatchingDonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life, MatchingDonors.com.
How would you like a sweet late afternoon treat with a steady rockin' beat that generates some heat to make your day complete? If so, be sure to check out the Go With The Flow Mike Holloway Show to hear what those rockin' blues are all about. Every Friday afternoon, 4 to 6 p.m., only on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Yeah!
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Time. That's where my